You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This is a show about peace, promoting it, preserving it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. Pacifica's KPFK's Sonali Kalhatar spoke with former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter about how the United States didn't allow Iraq to rebuild its civilian infrastructure after the first Gulf War, which led to death and disease amongst the civilian population.
I don't feel any need to reconcile anything. Notice you said that they're holding me up. I'm not presenting myself as anything more than what I am, an American citizen who's very concerned about the situation in Iraq. I'm thrilled to death that there's a group of Americans out there who agree with me. I think that there's more than just the liberal left or progressive left that's in agreement. I think that you're going to find that many mainstream moderate Americans and even some conservative Americans are very concerned about what's transpiring in Iraq. But I think the most important thing is this isn't about me and who people think I am or how I present myself. This is about an idea of, of war or peace, in which direction this country is heading in. And if I can be instrumental in pushing what I believe to be the proper idea, which is peace before war, then so be it.
What do you feel about the sanctions that followed the 1991 Gulf War, which have resulted, as UNICEF said, in something like 500,000 deaths of Iraqi children?
First of all, we have to understand the sanctions didn't follow the Gulf War. The sanctions preceded the Gulf War. They were instituted in August of 1990 through Resolution 661 following the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq. The purpose of the sanctions was to compel the Iraqi government into withdrawing from Kuwait prior to the international community have to resort to the use of force. Clearly, that didn't work. The sanctions were continued following the liberation of Kuwait, this time linked to Iraq's obligation to disarm. I think that at that time, the international community should have been aware that Iraq, especially the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, wasn't going to be swayed by economic sanctions. The purpose of economic sanctions is to apply pressure, and I love that term, applying pressure on the people. What does that mean? Starving them to death, denying them adequate medical facilities? And it's one thing to apply sanctions to a people who, where all that's going to happen is some belt tightening. But remember, sanctions were continued on an Iraq that had been devastated by military action, an Iraq which had its power grid deliberately targeted by the United States, which had water purification and water treatment capabilities targeted by the United States. We destroyed the basic civilian support infrastructure. So suddenly the concept of pressure meant that really we were committing some sort of genocide. And the numbers put forward by the United Nations support this. I think the sanctions have been a horrific shame on America. And the fact that the United States had a policy as set forth as early as 1991, that even if Iraq cooperated with its obligation to disarm, economic sanctions, which were linked to that cooperation, would be continued until which time Saddam Hussein was removed from power. It was American policy never to allow sanctions to be lifted under international law until which time a unilateral American policy was implemented, one that is in contravention of all Security Council resolutions. So I believe the sanctions will go down in history and should go down in history as a dark stain on the moral character of the United States, and every American should hold their head in shame at the death and suffering of the Iraqi people that's been done in their name, because it is an American policy. People can call it a United Nations policy, but the way the sanctions regime has been administered against Iraq is purely an American policy designed to create as much death and suffering among the Iraqi people as possible.
Now, you just said that that the military action of the United States in the first Gulf War targeted civilian infrastructure, which is in violation of, for example, the Geneva Convention. And you said you were proud to serve in that war. How do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, I'll dispute any concept of what we did as a violation of the Geneva Convention. If you had served in that war as I did, you'll know that we had more lawyers per square inch in the headquarters space going through each target recommendation and assessing it under the law of war. Let's not forget what we're talking about here, war. One of the reasons why I'm so against the United States going to war is that I understand what it's about. When we go to war, we kill people. We destroy things. It's not a game. And we went to war against Iraq in 1991. We went to war to kill people, to destroy things. That's war. It's hell. That's why you want to avoid it. I feel we had no choice but to go to war in 1991. I don't think the crime was committed in going to war. I think it's how we handled the aftermath of war. If you are going to target, you know, infrastructure in an effort to put pressure on a leadership, which is a legitimate action in times of war, once the war ends, I believe you have every obligation to rapidly reconstitute that civilian infrastructure which was targeted. The crime wasn't in bombing it. The crime was in prohibiting the Iraqis from having the means to reconstitute so that the people suffered. We knew darn well that in destroying the power infrastructure, the water purification infrastructure, and other aspects of the Iraqi civilian infrastructure, that we would be opening the door to severe malnutrition, severe disease issues months down the road. And the fact that we stood by and did nothing while the Iraqi people suffered, even once the war was finished, is where I believe the crime was committed.
Now, you have said recently this new Bush doctrine of American unilateralism reeks of imperial power, the very power against which Americans fought a revolution more than 200 years ago. How do you feel about past U.S. actions such as the support and active participation of the United States in repression and terrorism in Latin America and East Timor and Panama and so on, which many analysts have described as imperialism? Is it just now that the U.S. is acting as an imperial power, in your opinion?
Well, I'm not going to defend mistakes made in the past. I think one of the things all Americans have to do is be able to look at, you know, our history and learn from our history. Clearly, we've made many, many mistakes in the past, and we're going to make mistakes in the future. You know, in the United States, you know, we're in an unenviable position. I mean, you know, most people envy us for our power and for our lifestyle, and Americans, we're addicted to this lifestyle. But, you know, we have unique power. We are stronger than any nation's ever been. And, you know, the key is in how we use this power, how we exercise this power. We will make mistakes, and sometimes these mistakes are horrible, and we should learn from these mistakes. But at the end of the day, we're still a democracy, and there is the concept of accountability. And we at least pretend to be a member of the international community and to abide by international law. I think what differentiates are the sins of the past, and I'll call them sins. I'm not going to try and defend these policies. And what we're doing today is the deliberate nature in which we are totally walking away from international law, walking away from multilateralism. At least in the past, we pretended to go through the process of respecting international law while we operated in violation of international law. At this point in time, the Bush administration is just walking away from it and saying, no, this is about American unilateralism. We may have behaved as an imperial power and an improper power in the past. We are now defining ourselves as an imperial power, and that's where I have a problem. We make mistakes, and we should be held accountable for our mistakes. But as soon as we define ourselves as an imperial power, that means we are no longer the democracy that our founding fathers framed 220-some-odd years ago.
One last question, Scott Ritter. What do you think is going to happen now? Today, today Iraq has accepted the UN resolution, and if we go by, for example, the U.S.'s actions in Yugoslavia or even in 1991, with the pursuit of this war that Bush has essentially promised us, it seems as though they're going to try to trip Iraq up in any way possible. Do you think that will happen? And if so, how? What should we be watching out for?
Well, I think we have to keep in mind that the American policy objectives in regards to Iraq aren't disarmament. I mean, the Bush can say he wants to disarm Iraq, but what he's saying is he wants to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and that is our policy objective. And until the United States renounces this policy of regime removal, we have to assume that that is the intent of America's policy. Weapons inspections are the antithesis of regime removal. In fact, weapons inspections, if they're allowed to be carried out, if Iraq cooperates and then the inspectors are allowed to do their job, actually open the door to guaranteeing Saddam Hussein's continued survival for some time to come, which means that the last thing you think the Bush administration would want is to have successful inspections. I think that the Bush administration will do everything they can to trip the inspection process up, and I think they're going to even try and trip it up before the inspectors get back to work. You're going to see on December 8th, the Iraqis have to submit a declaration under the 30-day time period listing the totality of its holdings of weapons of mass destruction. The Iraqi government, in agreeing to allow inspectors to return today, said they don't have any weapons, and they welcome the inspectors. They don't fear the inspectors. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, said on Sunday that the United States knows Iraq has biological and chemical weapons. Now, of course, neither she, Donald Rumsfeld, or anybody else has been able to back this allegation up with anything that remotely resembles substantive fact, but they know. And she said if Iraq doesn't declare this, then we can assume that Iraq has no intention of abiding by their obligations, that they're just going to resume, cheat, and retreat, and they will initiate, the United States will initiate action under paragraph 4 of the new resolution 1441, which says any omission on the part of Iraq constitutes a continuing material breach of Iraq's obligations, thereby triggering military action.
Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter speaking with KPFK's Sony Kolhatkar. The American Public Health Association held its national conference in Philadelphia earlier this week. Among the items on the agenda were the passage of two resolutions against the impending war with Iraq. In the second part of our interview with the association's president, Bob Gould, he spoke of how he was not surprised that the resolutions received such an overwhelming support at the APHA.
The American Public Health Association, which is the oldest and largest public health association in the world, does have long-standing policies, many of which have actually been introduced by the Peace Caucus of the American Public Health Association, opposed to militarism in general and opposed to specific policies that fall under that rubric that the United States has pursued. So there was a position paper that was adopted by the American Public Health Association back in 1985, 1986, I can't remember exactly which year, and that one was critical of, as I was mentioning, militarism in general, the pursuit on the part of the U.S. to pursue policies that were very dangerous for the health of the world in terms of warfare throughout the world, what the cost to public health of war are. And many of these, the problems of war and its negative impacts on public health actually have been documented in two books that have been published by leaders of the American Public Health Association. I would cite one of them is called War and Public Health, and a more recent book is Terrorism and Public Health. And again, deals with, if you will, more upstream issues of dealing with terrorism. In terms of what are the policies that, for example, the United States has pursued historically, particularly its militaristic policies that have actually encouraged terrorist types of responses. Mm-hmm. This is not to mean that, you know, terrorism doesn't have at some level a life of its own, but if we are, as you know, committed health professionals concerned about the public health globally, we have to really seek to, as I mentioned before, more upstream solutions to deal with this.
What is the key concern with regard to the war in Iraq that's raised in your resolution? What is the key concern?
Well, there are a number of key concerns. In terms of a potential war in Iraq, certainly there have been a number of estimates put out, most recently actually by a report issued by the organization MEDAC that was just released within the last few days, documenting the fact that the expected casualties of a war that could be in the hundreds of thousands.
Did you have any difficulty getting this kind of resolution passed there?
Not at all. You know, as I mentioned earlier, these are completely consistent with previous policies that have been adopted overwhelmingly by the association, because the professional public health professionals recognize that the most effective way of dealing with health issues is to act as upstream as possible. That's central to public health. You get much more, if you will, bang for the buck by dealing with what we call primary health prevention, not reacting to problems when they come, by addressing the underlying causes. You get the most impact. It's far better to deal with the causes of diseases, or what we call emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases that flow from conditions of poor water and sanitation, and et cetera, than to start trying to react haphazardly with vaccine programs and things like that, which are, you know, should be an item of last resort in that case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, I can give you an example. The United Nations, in the year 2000, issued a report that indicated that $10 billion a year could provide enough clean water and sanitation that could cut by up to one-third the 4 billion cases of infectious diarrhea that occur worldwide. I mean, that's a major focus of endemic disease. And that causes 2 million deaths a year. That's $10 billion a year was equivalent to what the United States was paying for counterterrorism programs before 9/11. So we could see the trade-offs and the relative impact.
Okay, so basically your resolution is calling on the U.S. to have a more transparent inspection process.
Yes, we want to strengthen Biological Weapons Convention, and this is a way that we think, you know, all treaties don't solve all the problems in the world, but we certainly think that we should be doing carrying out the strongest effort possible to be able to make sure that these technologies cannot be developed. And these things can only be developed to have any sort of impact if there's the strongest level of global cooperation, which is why the rest of the world is so angry with the United States for walking out of this process. Here we're leveling all these charges against so-called rogue countries, but we're certainly behaving in quite a rogue fashion, not only in terms of the Biological Weapons Convention, but in terms of our attitude towards, as I mentioned, the Kyoto Accord, in terms of planning to develop new nuclear weapons, not ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. If you examine the right-wing literature, which I have done extensively in this regard, the significant policy advisors to the Bush administration have questioned the whole need to have treaty obligations like this, which is completely consistent with the very aggressive and unilateralist thrust of this administration.
Some Americans, however, may not see the connection between or the trade-off between war over there, so to speak, and the impact that it will have on Americans here.
Well, that's why I think it's very important that, again, the largest and oldest public health association in the world speak up, and that the issues that are being raised at the American Public Health Association get the widest possible circulation. That's why I'm very gratified that you're, carrying this issue on Pacifica, because I think this is what people need to understand. We don't hear this in the media. People are focused very much on, the scattered cases and the fears of terrorism, but they're not getting that type of analysis and understanding, which, again, is fundamental bedrock public health principles.
Bob Gold, president of the American Association of Public Health Officials.
Too many friends who believe that means it's justified bothering.
Robert Hoyt's Apple Pie from the CD As American as You, Watching for Peace. In this next segment of Peace Watch, straight from the streets of Houston, Texas, Mr. White, a KPFT volunteer and multimedia artist featured in January's Adbuster music compilation, takes a look into the minds of U.S. citizens coping with, as he calls it, an out-of-control government. This is his first street report.
Recently, I talked to five people I know about war and peace, past and present, and the ruthless dictator named George W. Bush. My first conversation was with Dot, an 80-year-old New York native.
We're very naive, but I mean, a lot of nasty things are happening too. Little by little, it's coming out what we've done. You know, we're not lily white. And as far as politics are concerned, we think of, you know, Lincoln and all those past. And think they were all great. They had some of the problems too. But, I mean, now, even if a man, you know, is dedicated, honest, wants to do good, he can't. Not when he gets to Washington. Mm-hmm. How can you, you know, there's always somebody lording over you, you know.
Yeah.
I think too much money is spent on campaigning anyway.
Yeah.
One way or the other. Can you imagine what we'd do if they put all that money to help people instead of all the money that goes on campaign?
Do you know what the defense budget is right now?
No, I don't know what
it is. It was just increased, one of the largest increases in decades, and it's now up to about $400 billion.
The thing is, you know, you have to defend yourself. Maybe it wouldn't have been better if we had become isolationists. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answers. Sometimes I listen to debates, so forth. But I mean, right now, I don't get involved in all of this. I do what I can. I pay my bills. I believe in God. And I've come a long way. I'm 80. I've come a long way. And I'm content, you know, doing what I have to do to live.
This is Janice, 79, from Houston.
What I can't understand is how they let their government go the way it is. While there aren't a few honest people who stand up and fight. So many of them, they say one thing and they know darn well they're doing another. And it just tears you up. And to think they can come back and people are so dumb. They come back and they get reelected again. I don't know how they do it.
Zach is a 27-year-old Kenya native who is now a naturalized U.S. citizen.
Do you think that Saddam is a real threat to the United States? As it is, I mean, if he wasn't being threatened by Bush and all this?
Actually, I thought he was a threat to some parts of the world, but not entirely, only United States. But not of immediate threat that warrants a war right now. That's why there are some hypocritical analogies that is portrayed by some of these developed nations. Mm-hmm. When they will say that they are fighting war, especially in Africa, where most of these countries, none of them make these weapons.
Yeah.
And what happens? How do they buy this weapon? How did the weapon get there in the first place before you start protecting individuals?
Mm-hmm.
You made the weapon and you send it there, and now you want them to beg you to come in to stop the war that you started.
This is Darlene, 28, from Houston.
When people do try to get together and speak out, it's completely ignored by the media. And when people don't make their voices heard, like when they don't show up to vote, nobody gives a damn. Nobody pays attention to that. Nobody calls that out either. So I think that we have a government that wants to act completely autonomously, that wants to act with very little involvement from the citizenry and do what's in the best interest of the business aspect. You know, I think obviously the government's making its decisions based on what their business partners are saying, not what their citizens are saying. Everybody talks about how our leaders have gone astray. Well, in a functioning democracy, it's not even supposed to be so much a leadership. They are stewards of the public trust. They're supposed to be carrying out our decisions, not making our decisions for us and then enforcing them. as far as foreign policy in this administration goes, all that they're doing is antagonizing the rest of the world, which puts us in greater danger. And simultaneously, they are completely ignoring the welfare of the citizenry so that we're falling apart from the inside as well. How is that defense? How is that security? You know, when you talk about national security, to me, whenever I think of the word security, I think of, you know, being safe and taken care of. That includes having shelter, having a warm bed to sleep in, having a full stomach, having, you know, knowing where your next meal is going to come from, knowing who can take care of your children for you while you work, knowing that if you get sick, you're going to be taken care of and you're going to be able to afford medication. That, to me, is security. Not knowing that we have, you know, countless bunkers full of tons and tons and tons of nuclear weapons, which can completely obliterate life on Earth many times over, that doesn't make me feel secure. Knowing that someone in office who is not representative of the will of the people has an unlimited budget and now completely unilateral, autonomous power, independent of our wishes, that doesn't make me feel secure. If you want to bring up that kind of logic that, you know, if our way of life changes, the terrorists have won. Well, our way of life has changed. I don't see people really examining the fundamental flaws in our society. It hasn't changed in that respect. I don't see people slowing down their consumption, so it hasn't changed in that respect, so the government got what they were asking for there. I mean, capitalism is still humming along pretty strong, but I think that we lost a great degree of our humanity.
That piece produced by KPFT volunteer Mr. White. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer today was Sidrak Franklin. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA, Lona Elias, and Toussaint Savoir, and Marcus Tyler Brown, Peace Watch's intern. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Bensky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their websites at pacificaarchives.org or calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.